First of all, maybe I would like to explain the title of the book, The Goddess Civilization of Old Europe. To some archaeologists and historians, it will be not very clear what is in the book. I must say that in the beginning, my title was different. It was Old Europe before the Indo-Europeans, or then also I considered another title, Old Europe before the Patriarchy. But this actual title was decided by the publishers. And, well, I send my blessings to it, but I know that it will not be easily accepted by archaeologists themselves, or it will be, or the book will be not touched for maybe 5 or 10 years. And then the young generation will come and will realize that this book is not a novel. In short, I would like to say what is in the book. I begin with the period of the introduction of the agriculture. This means the Neolithic. The Neolithic is understood to be the beginning of the agricultural period, of the settled life, New Stone Age. I actually even do not like this term, Neolithic or New Stone Age. It's more ceramic age, because pottery was so beautiful and so important. You know, if you go to excavate, first of all, you have to find some potsherds and then decide what is there in this mound or this settlement. So pottery would be more important, but actually the settled life began before pottery was discovered, so that's okay. Now we have another name, goddess civilization, for this period, so that also can be used. Or I introduce the term Old Europe, which is my creation. I started to use it in 1971, and in the beginning, as it is also used in my book of 74, and Gods and Goddesses or Goddesses and Gods of Old Europe, I use it for Southeast Europe. And Southeast Europe is the richest part of all of Europe, where Neolithic or agricultural beginnings are earlier than in, say, Western Europe or Central Europe. But after some time, I started to consider this term as Europe before the Indo-Europeans, Europe before the Patriarchy. And therefore, I apply it to all of Europe, west of Volga or west of Don, because I see that the social structure and religion was the same, that the symbolic structure was the same, and it was no wise Indo-European. So this is how I use it, as pre-Indo-European culture. Now, the making of this book was not 2 or 3 or 5 years. I would count 30 years at least, if not more. But this was not for writing only. Well, it included collecting of materials, excavation for 15 years, reading, and reading was not reading of 2 or 3 general books, but I would say 3,000 of articles and reports in about 20 languages of Europe. And I believe that archaeologists should base on primary sources and never trust secondary sources, because they are very frequently distorted. This also included an extensive travel. I would say for 20 years I went to Europe every year, and I talked to the colleagues in the museums. I made trips to the museums, and they are not two or three, but maybe 150 or so. So this way I count many years. The writing itself was maybe 4 or 5 years. And yes, it is true, this book was started much before The Language of the Goddess. The Language of the Goddess came in later. It had to be one chapter in this book, and it was not possible because I had to say more about the religion. I had to understand the symbolic structure. I had to understand the religion of old Europe, and it had to be another book. And what I have in this book is just a summary of it. In this book, I have descriptions of culture groups, and there are many, and they are changing in each period, and then I have descriptions of many other things, like I talk about the sacred script, I talk about the social structure, and many other things about architecture and pottery, and so on and so on. Now, my colleagues and journalists, interviewers always ask me a question, how come, why have you started to write about religion and other archaeologists didn't, and what was the cause, what was the preparation, why? Well, I would say this would be a long answer, but I know why I did it, and I can say why in a short way. There are several things to be considered. First, I am born in Lithuania, in Vilnius, and this country in my times was sacred. There were sacred rivers, there were sacred forests, there were sacred wells, there were sacred animals, there was sacred earth which had to be kissed in the morning and in the evening, and prayers had to be said. I saw all that in my childhood. In my young days, of course, I didn't have television, but my greatest joys were to greet the spring, to listen to the nightingales and cuckoos, and to talk to the blue spring flowers, djibutes. This was the atmosphere. And also in my own family, where history and folklore and folk art was before the study of the Bible. And also, there were, in my childhood, goddesses, real goddesses, Laima and Ragana, for instance, the goddesses of birth and rebirth and death and regeneration, and they were more real than the Indo-European male gods or even Christian gods. But I was especially interested in Virgin Mary, and I used to go to the church, especially in May, when they were singing and there were millions of flowers, and that is my most beautiful memory of the days. And I had an enormous amount of encouragement and freedom and love in my family. I really had a paradise. Then suddenly I lost it all with the first tanks of Soviet tanks in our country, and the life was very, very different. But I shall not say much more. I must now continue about my own career. For about 20 years, I was extremely interested in the origins of the Indo-Europeans, because I always knew from my childhood that my language, Lithuanian language, is one of the most conservative, archaic language, very similar to Sanskrit, and this intrigued me. But this was not all I was interested in. At the same time, I was researching symbols. When I was about 18, 20 years old, I was writing articles about the symbolism of the folk art. But then, at the same time, I studied archaeology. So now I have this background which continued to be, say, research of the Bronze Age, of weapons, typology of weapons, chronology of weapons. I devoted best years of my life to this difficult study, to the study to which I don't want to go back, but it created a background of my knowledge. And at Harvard, I went through the articles which existed in that best library of the world. And I had a real chance to do it. And they did it. And they published in 1956 a book called The Prehistory of Eastern Europe. And there I introduced the term the Kurgan culture which I equate with the Indo-Europeans who came from the Volga area to Europe. So since then, this is now, more than 30 years, I use this term. And in this new book, also this is used. And I think that, perhaps I'm right, though I don't say that my word is the last word. maybe there will be other better works, but at least I can say that I am sure that I was not biased. I had at that time no idea that I am making some contribution to the women, for instance. It was not in existence. I was just doing the work. And now why I came to the studies of the Neolithic and why I came to the studies of the symbolic structure, the goddess, this was quite a logical development. Because doing this work for 20 years, studying the social structure and armament of the warriors, I had to ask a question, why what I see in the museums, in my own excavations, things are so different? And why there is no connection between the two? Absolutely no connection. Cannot be a gradual development from one to the other. So it has to be understood. And then I plunged into the studies of the Neolithic. So it happened in the 60s with my coming to California, with my getting this professorship for the Bronze Age studies, for the weapon studies. and then I started to excavate, I started to do research, and after some time, after maybe this took the time about 6-7 years, I said, here I start to see. And in the beginning, I was quite enthusiastic, and this is why I published very soon the book in 1974, and the Goddesses and Gods of Old Europe. This was just first step, and it had to be followed by the second step, by the language of the goddess, and then, of course, by this book, which is a documentation of the whole thing. And it covers, in general, the European culture during the period from 7,000 to 3,000 BC. So this is, in short, my story. And now I shall say something about the civilization itself and how I consider this to be important for us today. I would like to say that the present concept of civilization, universally accepted by archaeologists and historians, means society is characterized by hierarchical, man-dominated political and religious organization, and by class stratification and the complex division of labor. Some scholars equate civilization and history, since a number of things seem to have happened pretty much at once. Patriarchal cities in the Near East came to the scene, writing for economic purposes, exploitation, private property, subjugation, and other things. To some scholars, culture was born when men learned to master women and nature. This definition excludes past cultures in which androcratic societies are not represented, yet whose way of life seems to have had a higher quality than the androcratic societies. Such was old Europe and its heirs, especially in the Aegean and the Mediterranean area, particularly the Minoan culture of Crete in the second millennium. These civilizations enjoyed a long period of uninterrupted peaceful living and blossoming art. The non-material aspects of culture, artistic creation, aesthetic achievements, values concerned with life, ideology, and philosophy, which make life meaningful and enjoyable, these are what should be stressed. And as Gloria said, I reject the definition of civilization as that which embraces only the warrior societies. Actually, if we consider the whole of man's history, the androcratic warrior societies lasted only a moment's time, the last 5,000 years. Widespread fighting and fortification building have indeed been the way of life for most of our direct ancestors from the Bronze Age, around, say, 3000 BC until now. Pugnacity, plundering, and love of glory are typical only of patriarchal societies, such as the Indo-European. However, that was not the case in the many thousands of years of peaceful life during the Upper Paleolithic and Neolithic periods. There are no depictions of arms, weapons used against other humans in any Paleolithic cave paintings. The archaeological evidence for the hordes of brutal cavemen just does not exist. There are no remains of weapons used by men against men, no signs of groups of humans being slaughtered. Recent research defines early humans of several million years as generally peaceful and cooperative. For instance, Richard Leakey's work, Origins, of 1979. Early gatherers and hunters lived most likely in fluid, flexible, egalitarian groups with a strong bond between mother and her children who formed the nucleus of society. There are many books on, for instance, the origin of war, in which the beginning of the agricultural period is considered to be also a beginning of warrior society, which is nonsense in my mind. This is a distortion of actual evidence. Such statements are illustrations that general writers are not informed about the actual evidence. The goddess civilization took keen delight in the natural wonders of this world. Its people did not produce lethal weapons or build forts in inaccessible places as their successors did. Instead, they built magnificent tomb shrines and temples and comfortable houses and created superb pottery, textiles, and sculptures. Architecture seemed to grow organically out of the earth's locality. This was a long-lasting period of remarkable creativity and stability. Their culture was a culture of art. The goddess religion reflects a gynocentric social order for most of early human history. I describe the social structure of old Europe as matrilineal, avuncular, endogamic, ruled by a queen priestess and assisted by a council of women and assisted by her brother or uncle, who was an overseer of trade, of architecture, of navigation, of mining, and so on. Cultural patterns of sexual equality and nonviolence were established traditions for many thousands of years. Archaeological discoveries have revealed societies in which male dominance, warfare, and a generally hierarchic and authoritarian social structure was not the norm. Such were the early agricultural societies in Europe and the Near East and in many other parts of the world, as well as the most advanced civilization of Minoan Crete, which followed the Neolithic. The lexicon of prehistory, images and symbols, assert that the self-generating goddess has been the most persistent feature in the archaeological record of the ancient world. The father image is not known to old Europe. The goddess, in all her manifestations, was a symbol of the unity of all life in nature and the whole universe. Her power was in water and stone, in moon, sun, and fire, in animals and birds, snakes and fish, in hills, trees, and flowers, in bees and butterflies. Hence the holistic perception of the sacredness and mystery of all there is on earth. Mysticism is part of human experience. Early civilizations that lasted many thousands of years trained everyone in them to be mystical. Ours is an anti-mystical era, full of despair and cynicism. The goddess personifies the reproductive and destructive energies of nature. The deep perception of the periodicity of nature, of seasons, of life cycles, and of the changing moon led to a strong belief in the regeneration of life at the crisis of death. The main motif of goddess religion was the celebration of life energy. The life force that fuses male and female, generating life and accepting death as part of the cycle of life. I say not male or female, but both together. What the goddess is about is the divine power of creativity intrinsic to all things. It is about divinity inside things. Paleolithic and Neolithic symbols reveal a philosophy of human life that is in every aspect contrary to the anti-mysticism of our time. It is not at all astonishing that prehistoric religion and art is not a subject of great interest to archaeologists. It is much more to artists and poets. Commenting on the writing of prehistorians, William Irwin Thompson writes in the book The Time Falling Bodies Take to Light, 1981, because we have separated humanity from nature, subject from object, values from analysis, knowledge from myth, and universities from the universe, it is enormously difficult for anyone but a poet or a mystic to understand what is going on in the holistic and metapoetic thought. The very language we use to discuss the past speaks of tools, hunters, and men. When every statue and painting we discover cries out to us that this Ice Age humanity was a culture of art, the love of animals and women. Art and religious symbols of old Europe were hardly studied by archaeologists. More was intuitively perceived by poets, artists, by religious historians and Jungian psychologists. I have in mind series of books which are very important, and they were important for me, like Professor E. James, professor of Oxford, who was teaching about the goddess in the 50s and published a book, The Cult of the Mother Goddess, in 1959, or the book by Eric Neumann, who published The Great Mother in 1955, or Robert Graves, who published The White Goddess in 1972. Then I have in mind Mircea Eliade's work on Birth and Rebirth, 1958, Patterns in Comparative Religion, 1958. I would also like to mention the great classicist Jane Harrison, who published Themis in the 20s, which was a great book to me. So therefore, old Europe for a long time is not understood wholly. It is known from fragments and known from separate regions, either British Islands or Central Europe or Italy or Greece or Scandinavia, but never as a whole thing. And mostly what was published recently was economy, settlement pattern, and so on. It was considerably easier to understand what is the Minoan culture some 3,000 years later, because it was excavated by a brilliant British archaeologist, Arthur Evans, in the very beginning of the century, and was published in the 20s, so people were informed about this culture better than about the earlier culture. Some scholars have described Minoan life as perfectly expressive of the idea of homo ludens, of man expressing our higher human impulses through joyful and at the same time mythically meaningful ritual and artistic play. Others have tried to sum up Cretan culture in phrases such as grace of life and love of beauty and nature. The majority of scholars, and certainly those who have done any extensive field work on the island, seem quite unable to contain their admiration and even astonishment in describing their finds. Here we have a technologically and culturally advanced civilization where life in its totality, as well as death, were deeply entrenched in an all-pervasive religion. The emphasis was on technologies aimed at sustaining and enhancing people's lives. Speaking of Minoan culture, I always, or say frequently, think, what could have developed in Europe if it was not destroyed? And, well, we would have been in a very different situation now. I also remember how I excavated in Yugoslavia, for instance, 20 years ago in southeast Yugoslavia near the Bulgarian border. My students lived in cow dung sheds, and it was filthy. There was no order in the village, and at night there were vicious dogs, and it was so frightening when you had to go out and find a pit with a board across. So, of course, it is clear there was no progressive development of culture from old Europe to our times. goddess civilization perished. It perished in the beginning just in the Danubian region. But destruction started there at the end of the fifth millennium and continued for nearly 2,000 years. It transformed a peaceful, gynocentric old European culture into an androcratic one, typified by Hilfords, weapons, and patriarchal and patrilineal structure, which is reconstructed quite well on the basis of comparative Indo-European linguistics and comparative Indo-European mythologies. A constant and frightening escalation of armament and war followed. Today, we are the witnesses of the climax of this development. And we happen to live in time, which is the end of an era. The end of the 5,000 years of what James Joyce has termed the nightmare. And the end of the 20th century, a century of wars, tortures, and massacres. As Thomas Berry says, we have to reinvent the human species or perish. We must re-examine history and start putting back some parts that we have left out. Namely, the earth, the body, the feminine, and the unconscious. In our commitment to make progress at any cost during the last 300 years, we fail to see the universe is limited by organic laws. We have gone through a period of isolating ourselves, and we are just now discovering that we have no future. That we are extinguishing life itself. From Oswald Spengler's work, the Decline of the West, Untergang des Abendlandes, and through the works of Teilhard de Chardin, Toynbee, Thomas Berry, Brian Swaim, and many others, and now Charlene Spretnak's work, States of Grace, we get an important message which offers a new view of the civilization process, an organic model linking the history of humankind with the story of the earth and the story of life. Rianne Eisland, in her book, The Chalice and the Blade of 1987, introduced a new term, gilani, to describe the non-violent, non-hierarchical society before the patriarchy. Gi derives from the Greek word gyne, woman. An derives from andros, the Greek word for man. The letter L between the two represents the fundamental organizational principle predominant in this type of ideology and society, linking rather than, as in androcracy, ranking. Old Europe, the ancient Near East, and Minoan Crete were Gilanese. Gilani was not what we would, under the prevailing paradigm, call matriarchy, because it is understood as a mirror image of patriarchy. A fundamental difference between Gilani and androcracy lies in their values and social priorities. In Gilani, neither half of humankind was subordinated. An essential feature of androcracy is the relegation of the feminine virtues. We cannot return to a less advanced technological level. The question at issue today is only how we can use what we are learning about our early cultural heritage to fashion a more Gilanic ideology and save our planet. There is an evident relevance to the universally recognized need in our time for general transformation of consciousness. We should draw energy and strength not from periods of cruelty and destruction, but from earth-centered and life-reverencing cultures. I am extremely happy that the publication of my books coincided with the resurrection of Mother Earth and with the need to bring spirituality into our beings and into our ecological world. Thank you very much. Thank you.